NC State's Audio Abstract. I'm your host, Tracy Peake. How and why do planets look the way they do? What can Earth tell us about other planets, and vice versa? Paul Byrne is an assistant professor of planetary geology here at NC State, who studies how tectonic, volcanic, and impact processes shape planetary surfaces, and what they can teach us about both distant worlds and our own. In part one of this two-part podcast, we talked with Paul about what planetary geology is. In part two, we'll talk more about Venus and our other solar system neighbors. What do we know about Venus? What's going on there? I mean, I know it's hard to see anything because it's a giant gas cloud atmosphere covering it, but what have we found out about Venus?
So it turns out we've found out a lot of the low-hanging stuff. We know a lot about Venus, but unfortunately that's raised questions that we really should answer because they probably really, really important, and we don't have the data to answer those questions definitively. But what we do know is we know it's about the same size and mass as Earth. Maybe it's about 80% the size of Earth, 90%, depending on you count volume or mass. But it's an Earth-sized world. It's got a surface that's covered in volcanoes. We recognize them because they have the same shape as landforms on Earth. There's a lot of tectonic activity. We know what the surface is. It's probably largely made of basalt, which is what most of the surface of Earth is made of. That's what the ocean plates are made of. In fact, we see that same rock type on Mercury, on the Moon, and Mars. This rock type is probably everywhere throughout the cosmos. We know that the atmosphere is CO2 rich. It's about 96.5% pure CO2, a little bit of other stuff in there, but it would kill you extremely quickly. We know the surface temperature is that of a self-cleaning oven. The surface pressure is about more than half a mile under the water equivalent on Earth, so it's a hellish place. We know that the atmosphere as a whole has a quite different structure to Earth's atmosphere. We know that there are parts about 55 or 60 kilometers, maybe 40 miles above the surface, where in fact the temperature and pressure are the same as this room right now, so you could safely operate a spacecraft there, or you could even put astronauts in the future once they were able to have rebreathers. We know a lot about the basics of Venus, but one of the things that was really surprising when we explored Venus in the 60s, 70s, 80s in particular, was that Venus does not have that many impact craters. Now, I mentioned earlier that one of the most characteristic things we see on planetary surfaces are impact craters, and we see them everywhere. And even the outer satellites that orbit Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, they're covered in impact craters. So impact craters, they're not a surprise. The only reason we don't have very many on Earth is because they tend to get eroded, filled in, buried. But Earth surely had many, many huge ones early in its days. But what we see when we look at impact craters in the solar system is that, generally speaking, and we have good reason to think this, the more craters on a piece of a planetary surface, the older it is, simply because it's had longer to accrue a record of impact cratering. There are hundreds of thousands, millions, depending on how small you count, on Mercury, Mars, the Moon, even some of the icy satellites in the outer solar system. There are fewer than 1,000 craters on Venus, and that's really weird. And there certainly are none of the really gigantic basins, we call them impact basins, that you see on Mercury or the Moon or Mars. And the reason for that is surely not because Venus didn't have them, but because some process or combination of processes has acted to remove them, to bury them. And one of the most effective ways you can bury something is you can have lava. And we know in Earth's geological record, there were periods of time in Earth's history where unbelievable volumes of lava poured out of the ground really, really quickly over huge areas. And they would be quite effective at filling in some of these impact craters and basins. So the discovery on Venus in the 60s and 70s in particular, that there are only about 1,000 craters, was genuinely surprising because it means that relatively recently, and there's me using that word as a geologist again, perhaps within the last billion years, but that's still very recent, something acted to bury most of the really big craters and basins on Venus. And we don't know why, and we don't know when, and we don't quite know how. But that was a genuinely surprising discovery because we don't see that anywhere else in the inner solar system. We see some other weird textures and combinations of tectonic structures that we don't really see anywhere else except on Earth. Now, we know that Venus does not have an Earth plate tectonics-like thing. It doesn't have the areas where it spreads apart in the ocean floors and where it subducts under big giant mountain belts. It doesn't quite have that pattern. But there's definitely some sort of movement and motion of the surface of Venus at a much greater scale than we see for Mars, Mercury, or the Moon. And because some of these flows, we think they're lava flows that have built in, are buried in, and filled in some of these large basins, have to be relatively young, a few hundred million years, that raises the tantalizing question of whether or not Venus might be active today. It's my guess that it is, but we do not have the data to hand with what we currently have available to be able to definitively answer it. And there's one more thing that's really interesting about Venus that's worth talking about. A few probes, not many, not enough, but a few probes were sent into the atmosphere from the Soviet Union and one probe from the US, Pioneer Venus, in the 70s and 80s. And some of these probes detected an interesting chemical property in the atmosphere. And they found an isotope ratio of water that really was quite surprising. We call it the deuterium-hydrogen isotope ratio, but what it means basically is the amount of this heavy type of water in the atmosphere in Venus is more than 100 times greater than what we see in Earth's atmosphere today. And one of the ways we can explain this, and this really is tantalizing, is that it's possible at some point in Venus's distant past, it could have had as much water, if not more, on its surface in some kind of form than Earth does today.
But somehow it ended up in the atmosphere?
Well, because of this particular ratio suggests that, in fact, not only is it some of it left in the atmosphere, but the lighter stuff is now lost to space.
Oh.
And it raises this idea, and this was originally proposed in the 60s. Before we really began to explore Venus, there were these great ideas that if you purely take Venus's distance to its to the sun, to its star, that it would be not very much warmer than Earth, but a bit warmer, maybe a few tens of degrees. And so in the 50s, as recently as the 50s, in these science fiction stories, people would paint covers of these books as these luscious forests and jungles. And we wondered maybe this was like a weird jungle planet, some sort of humid Earth. And it was really only in the early 60s when we began to send spacecraft to visit, to fly past and then ultimately to orbit, we realized, no, the surface of the temperature is hundreds of degrees. And that put paid to the idea of the forests. But what was interesting was we suddenly realized you can't just imagine or predict the conditions of the surface of a planet simply by its proximity to the sun. And so folks began to think, well, how would you get there? How would you take a world that really ought to be quite like Earth in terms of what it's made of and which part of the solar system it's in? It's around the same kind of star. Why is it so different? And then when we found out this isotope ratio difference in the atmosphere and the possibility that originally was much, much more liquid water on the surface of Venus, it raised this sort of almost kind of tragic idea that at some point in its past there might even have been oceans on the surface of Venus, liquid water oceans. It may have looked just like Earth today. It might have been blue. There'd be white clouds, water-rich vapor clouds. And under an increasingly hot sun, there's an interesting angle here that again, this is where astronomy and geology work perfectly together. The sun has been getting brighter and hotter as it gets older. This is a thing all stars do. It's a normal thing. It's been known for a very long time. If you go back far enough, the sun was originally pretty much dimmer and certainly much cooler. And you go back 2, maybe 3 billion years, and you imagine a scenario where Venus is a lot like Earth is today. Now, we don't know if it's got green on it. We don't know if it's got plants or life of any kind. We don't want to make that jump.
Right. There was not a jungle Venus.
We don't know, but there certainly would have been a lot of water sitting on the surface. And then the sun gets brighter and hotter, and it starts to raise the surface temperature slowly, naturally. This is not like human-driven climate change, which happens over a couple of centuries. This is probably a much, much longer process, but a more frightening process, because whatever about us fixing our climate problems on Earth today from anthropogenic climate change, this is a thing with the sun. I mean, this is
you
no
can't
fixing.
Stop
you
the
can't
sun.
Fix this.
Yeah,
this. Now, it's also worth pointing out, this is not affecting human children. Right. The sun has been behaving pretty well over the last few hundred years, and it will continue to do so.
Right.
But over a billion-year time frame, the sun gets hotter and brighter. And so we have this idea, this concept that as the sun gets hotter and brighter, the surface temperature of Venus gets higher and higher. And if you begin to sort of evaporate the oceans a bit faster than you would otherwise, and you slowly start to put more and more water vapor into the atmosphere. And as you do this, you actually end up into what's called a moist greenhouse effect. And suddenly it becomes that bit easier to hang on to that moisture in the atmosphere, and you actually drive more and more evaporation until eventually, under this brightening sun and this ever more humid atmosphere, you trigger what's called a runaway greenhouse effect. And this frightening phenomenon basically means that you reach a threshold beyond which you cannot stop this runaway train, and you get ever hotter, ever more evaporation. Your water eventually gets completely moved up to the atmosphere, and you boil off your oceans. And if this happens, then a lot of the water will reach the very highest parts of the atmosphere, where the sun will chemically react with it and drive off a lot of that water, leaving that ever more heavy isotope behind, which is what's driving the ratio we know in Venus's atmosphere today. And there's another interesting angle of this. Plate tectonics, we discussed earlier, is a really important thing for keeping a planet's temperature fairly regulated. Well, one of the things plate tectonics needs, is water. Because the sediments that contain all this carbon that's, you know, in the ocean from these shells, that sediment is full of water. And as the plate dives down under the continent, that water helps lubricate that process. It makes it a bit easier for that plate to get down. And once that plate's down, you can fairly reliably sure that it's going to continue going down, and you can keep the plate tectonic process alive. If you start to boil off your oceans under this runaway greenhouse effect, and you suddenly lose the water that's lubricating this process, even if Venus had plate tectonics, which is a massive and unanswered question, but if it did, and it was somehow able to regulate its temperature through this process and trap the carbon that the volcanoes are putting into the atmosphere. Once you lose the water, this plate tectonic process will stop. And once that stops, now you lose the ability to control your temperature the way you might have had some chance of offsetting this ever more evaporation of your oceans. The inside of Venus, which is generating all this heat energy, it has no idea what's going on. It doesn't care. Which means your volcanoes will continue to erupt, which means you're going to continue to put huge volumes of lava onto the surface. But now you won't be able to kind of keep things nice and cool because you won't be putting these cold plates into the inside and producing new ones at the spreading center in the ocean. That whole thing jams up. But you could produce a lot of material still from the inside, and eventually, it's thought, some of that of this material will reach the surface and cover huge areas of the surface in very, very short periods of time, which might be the way that you bury all those original craters that might have been there and make the surface look relatively geologically young. So this idea of the brighter, hotter sun evaporating the oceans explains why Venus might look the way it does today with relatively few craters, why it might have more tectonic and volcanic activity than the other planets in the solar system except Earth, but not quite like Earth, and it explains that odd chemical property in the atmosphere. And we don't know this. We could test all this with a variety of missions, landers, orbiters, flyby. But what's important is we at least have a framework to help answer a really critical question. Was there originally a period of time in the solar system when there were two Earth-like worlds side by side? And that has all kinds of implications for if you have a habitable world, are you sure you're going to hang on to it? Are you going to be able to keep those conditions in place long enough for complex life to evolve? And this has implications not just for our understanding of Venus, is implications for the geological history and the future of Earth. The sun is going to continue to brighten. It's going to continue to warm up. There is a possibility that within the next 1 or 2 billion years, what happened to Venus is definitely going to happen to Earth. The world we think of today, that it's been like this for a few hundred million years, for a few thousand million years, it's going to look like Venus in about 2 billion years' time. We think, or at least there's a possibility. Understanding whether this applies to Venus helps us understand the fate of our own world, to say nothing of the fact that we are discovering more and more rocky worlds in other solar systems. And if we can understand the rules governing how planets about the size of Earth behave, which path do you take, Earth or Venus? That's going to be really, really important for us to understand what we're looking at to make sense of what we see as we discover more and more Earth-like worlds in other solar systems.
Well, that is both terrifying and fascinating. So, that brings me to some other questions. The Venus stuff is amazing, and certainly super cool. But what is something, like, the most interesting thing that you've discovered in your research?
What's really interesting, I think, is that somewhere between Mars and Jupiter is what we call the frost line. Sometimes it's called the snow line or the ice line, but the concept is the same. You get sufficiently far from the sun that water can exist in ice form. And so this is presumably, this concept applies to any solar system, any star system, anywhere. Beyond the frost line, you get the what we call the giant planets, the gas giants and the ice giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And these worlds all have moons of their own. Now, some of them are rocky, but most of them are covered in an icy shell. And this icy shell is simply because at those distances from the sun, at the temperatures at that part of the solar system, ice can form the solid, or water can form the solid. And it's so cold, this solid is essentially as strong as rock, which means we see a lot of the same kinds of landforms like tectonic structures or even impact craters on these icy shells that look very similar to what they look like on rocky worlds in the inner solar system, because the ice really is that cold and that hard. What's interesting, what's fascinating about some of these worlds is that we have indirect evidence in most cases that there might be a liquid water ocean underneath those ice shells. So you can imagine that you might have a rocky world. It's still made of rock in the way that we understand the inner solar system worlds to be made of. But on top of this rock, there's a liquid water ocean. And on top of that, the upper part of that ocean has frozen into this ice shell. And that's the bit we can see. So we only really know the outer plate is made of ice, and we know that because we have devices, instruments that can measure what stuff is made of, composition spectrometers, and they tell us that it's water, ice, and various stuff mixed in. But we have a bunch of indirect evidence for most of these worlds, that there's a liquid water ocean. In fact, for one, we have direct evidence. There's a world called Enceladus, which orbits Saturn. Enceladus is tiny. I come from Ireland, so if you imagine basically Britain and Ireland together, Enceladus is about that big. That's not big for a moon.
That is not big, no.
And Enceladus has craters and it has fractures and stuff and things we recognize in the inner solar system. But Enceladus has these huge 4 or 5 giant fractures or cracks at its south pole from which water is blasting out in jets right now. And it's been doing this, we don't know for how long, but probably for a very long period of time. But we discovered these with NASA's Cassini mission, which visited and operated in the Saturn system from 2004 until 2017. And in 2005, we imaged these plumes, these jets, erupting from the south pole of Enceladus. In fact, Cassini flew through these plumes to sample what was in there. And not only do we determine that the plumes are made dominantly of particles of ice, so it's water, and therefore it's probably liquid water at depth, there were organic compounds inside these as well. Now, remember earlier we said there's three things we would look for life, or at least for habitability. We want organic compounds, we want water, we want some sort of energy source. So before this discovery, people have been thinking about what might happen on the ocean floors of these worlds, where you have the ice, you have a thick water ocean, and then you have this rocky seafloor that the ocean is situated. And when we discovered these organic particles coming out of these jets of Enceladus, that raised the possibility that maybe there were places in the solar system, many places in the solar system, where water and rock were touching, and where there were organic compounds. So you got your first tick, water. Organic compounds, if they're in Enceladus, and it turns out there are organic compounds that does not mean life, but carbon long-chain organic molecules. We find those in asteroids. We find them on the surface of comets. We know that they exist in the north pole of Mercury. They exist in poles of the moon. Organic compounds form huge molecular clouds in deep space. So organic compounds seem to be really common. Now, again, not proteins, amino acids, something like that.
Right.
We're seeing organic compounds throughout the cosmos. So that's our second thing ticked. The third thing, energy. Well, what is really interesting is when rock and water interact, they drive chemical reactions that form new minerals. And in the processes of forming these new minerals, they produce things like hydrogen, which can be an energy source. It can be something that something can use and ingest. Bacteria could fix it, for example. So you can have energy at rock-water interactions. If you have rock-water interactions, you have water. If you have them interacting, you have energy. And if you have organic compounds, as told to us by Enceladus, then you have your third of that trifecta. You got the organic compounds. So for the last 15, 20 years, longer, but certainly the last 15 years, there's been a huge interest in understanding these icy satellites as potential habitable places. Does not mean life, but it might mean where those three compounds or those three things, those three factors are existing together. So work that I've been doing with some colleagues has been to understand what the ocean floors of these worlds look like. And we talked earlier on that we look at other planetary surfaces that we can photograph to understand what they look like. We cannot look at the ocean floors of these worlds because in all cases they're hidden to us. At least right now, there are some audacious ideas as to how we could melt through the ice shell and then deploy a submarine. But we're hundreds of years probably from that technology. So we're not in my lifetime going to image or photograph the surface. So we figured out, well, with the little bit of data we have, what might they look like? If you were able to sail over in a submarine, what would the ocean floors look like? Would they be full of tectonic processes? Would they have chains of seamounts and volcanoes? Would they be teeming with life? Or would they be quiet and dark and featureless, like the abyssal plains in our deepest parts of our oceans? So we've taken a bunch of data we have available. We have some geophysical data that suggests what the inside might look like. We take data we know of how rocks behave. Because remember, that the ocean is sitting on regular rock. We don't quite know what it's made of, but we can make some educated guesses for what it's made of. And we have a fairly good idea as to how rock behaves under different pressures. And our question is this. You have rock and water touching for these worlds. For rock and water to interact and to drive these chemical reactions that could provide an energy source for life if it happened to be there, you need the rock and the water to touch and to continue to do so. And the way that happens on Earth, at these hydrothermal vents we talked about earlier on, is that you have plate tectonics driving with a huge amount of energy, pulling the crust apart. You create fractures. The water percolates through these fractures. It communicates the rock. You get these chemical reactions. But very quickly, you fill those cracks up with minerals that you precipitate out. And we understand that on Earth. We see lots of examples in the rock record. But you've got a lot of energy from plate tectonics that's making new cracks, new fractures. So you're constantly forming a new way of making fractures in which the water and the rock are introduced for the first time, that particular local place, generating new energy. So you keep this process going. And our critical question for these ocean worlds is, for their seafloors, sure, maybe the rock and water touch for a while, and that might generate energy for a while, but can you do this over the lifetime of the solar system? Is there some mechanism, some energy source, a stress, that will break the seafloor, create these new fractures, get the water and the rock interacting, they seal up, is there a way you can make new fractures, and therefore keep that environment habitable over hundreds to thousands of millions of years? And some of the work we've been doing so far suggests that, sure, there might be a fairly long history of rock and water touching for maybe a few tens of millions of years. But so far, we have not come up with a mechanism of keeping new fractures being made and keeping old fractures open over the lifetime of the solar system. So they might be habitable worlds for a while, habitable environments, and where for a time that trifecta of water, organics, and energy exist together. But keeping that process going over geological time seems to be, from our results so far, really difficult to do. And if that's true, then we do need to reconsider these worlds as potential places to look for evidence of current life.
I've been speaking today with Paul Byrne, an assistant professor of planetary geology here at NC State. I'm Tracy Peake. This has been Audio Abstract. Thanks for listening.